This is Myrna Kaiser. The title of the course is Session, Contemporary Christian View of Suffering. And I'd like to do three things today. First, focus very briefly on suffering in contemporary society. A summary, my evaluation, my summary, and then open it up to discussion, okay? Responses in the darkness. We covered the Old Testament, the idea that the people in the Old Testament asked, why must we suffer so? And the conclusion was because of punishment. First punishment of the nations, and then punishment of individuals. And then the retribution ethic, which said those who sin will be punished, those who are just will receive reward. And then we have the attitude of the question of the justice of suffering. And Isaiah, Psalms, Job asked about the distribution or justice of suffering. Then into the New Testament yesterday, we learned that Jesus faced his suffering. And Paul perceived suffering from the standpoint of faith. Okay, today just briefly summarizing our responses of suffering in contemporary society. We've talked a lot about denial, that we all deny our hurts, our suffering, and we deny other people's hurts. But I would like to add some more. And that the first word I have, sentiment. And I think our popular contemporary music especially is guilty of this. So much of our contemporary music and literature depicts hopelessness and despair and says that the only answer to life is to depend on ourselves and its sentiment. And I think that's probably too why so many themes, it's love, you know, that's the answer. And I'm sure resentment, another one, I'm sure that you know many people displace resentment. This person exhibits disbelief, helplessness, anger, bitterness, rebellion, depression, and asks, why did this happen to me? What have I done to deserve this? I'm really combining a lot in there. I think our society is, for example, plagued with depression. I would say in the parish, depression is number one problem. And I think a lot of depression is anger and resentment against what is happening to them. What I said was this person, the person who is resentful, exhibits disbelief and helplessness, anger, bitterness, rebellion, and asks, why does this happen to me? What have I done to deserve this? Judy, I will give you this. withdrawal. Non-involvement. One thing that I found in my second parish in old mining regions, Pennsylvania, was a lot of depression, but beyond that, a lot of withdrawal. People would literally stay in their homes and would not face life. They would completely withdraw and would not be involved with other people. Of course, another withdrawal, and I hesitate using this, but another type of withdrawal would be Buddhism, type of prayer and meditation. You really eliminate your interest in life, and then you will also end up eliminating suffering in a sense. Now we could get into a discussion here too, but I think this is one way of responding to suffering. Okay, illusion. Pain has no real existence, and it exists only in your mind, and of course, this would be a belief of Christian Scientists, that pain is not reality. Resignation, attitude, well, it has got to be, therefore we must put up with it. This would be the attitude of fatalists, Muslims, and some Christians. Fatalists will say, whatever is to be, will be. Muslims say, it is the will of Allah. And some Christians, it is God's will. And so this attitude leaves suffering still the master. Welcome. And then the humanistic view, suffering is the result of human failure. And we can eliminate human failures. We can just change. Change is within us. And that's probably kind of, all this is really simplistic and really a summary of some of our contemporary attitudes. And then we come to the Christian view, and stated very simply from our studies, I think what the Christian does is the Christian accepts suffering and faces suffering. And we certainly learn this from the example of Christ. Evil and suffering root fundamentally in the basic human condition, for which there must be a transformation, recreation, and redemption. Some human suffering is rooted in human mistakes, but basically there is something fundamentally wrong with the human race for which only God has the answer. Basically, the Christian accepts suffering while others try to avoid it. And so this was supposed to be a whole session, suffering in contemporary society, which I've just summarized. Would anyone like to make any comments before we go on? Okay, I would like to share from Isaac Singer's novel, Sasha. It's a story of Jews in Warsaw in the years prior to the First World War, and I'm kind of summarizing this little incident as kind of an introduction to our discussion today. Singer concludes the story with this dialogue between two of the survivors. Heimel tells how he lies awake at night wondering what sense all of the suffering of the Jewish people makes. What need was there for all of this? And I wait for an answer. What do you think, Tussek? Is there an answer somewhere or not? No, no answer. Why not? There can't be any answer for suffering, not for the sufferer. In that case, what am I waiting for? Dinya, Himmel's wife, opened the door. Why are you two sitting in the dark, huh? Heimel laughed. We're waiting for an answer. I think Singer's point is well made. There is really no answer to suffering, at least for the sufferer. Suffering remains the dark mystery of human existence, unyielding to all the efforts of humankind over the centuries to dissolve it. Too many humans, religious and secular, have experienced the agony of unexplainable suffering for anyone to attempt to say that this or that is the answer we have all sought. This is to say that any discussion of suffering must stand within the context of an all-pervasive qualification. In the midst of suffering itself, all discussions of it fade into insignificance. Now, Maybe I should have ended our session with that.
It doesn't occur.
No.
Maybe I needed to read that before our discussion to qualify, you know, my conclusions. To say that we can struggle with this, and we will continue to struggle with it, but there are really no answers. In light of what we've been doing this week, I have made three affirmations of our biblical view of suffering. The first one is suffering is sometimes, but not always, associated with sin and evil on the part of the sufferer. The retribution ethic of the Old Testament is based on the premise that when suffering occurs, it is always and everywhere the result of sin. This perspective is the result of the effort to universalize the relationship and of sin and suffering, and to affirm the righteousness is rewarded in this earthly life with blessings, including freedom from suffering. Of course, the danger of this view is that it constitutes a simplistic understanding of suffering, and in the end does violence to the justice of God. The faith of the Israelites included the confidence that righteousness was rewarded in the course of this human life. The logical extension of that conviction was the corollary that sinfulness was punished in this life. It was, however, one thing to say that sin leads to suffering, and quite another thing to say that wherever there is suffering, it has been caused by sin. Hence, the so-called friends of Job keep insisting that Job's suffering is the result of his sin and that he should confess that sin. The reality of the suffering of the righteous person was the hammer which crushed the retribution ethic. And simplistic though it was, the retribution ethic articulated certain real-life experiences. One of those experiences which lay behind the formulation of this view of suffering was surely a consciousness that sometimes sin does produce suffering. And it is that experiential reality which continues to be important for the contemporary Christian. Sin is sometimes the result, suffering is sometimes the result of sin. We think, for instance, of the physical suffering brought on by the person who ignores the fact that alcohol is injurious to the body, or the person who distorts his or her mind with drugs day after day, or the emotional pain of those who continually put themselves down, denying God's creative potential in them until they have become the persons they imagine themselves to be. It is this simple fact that sinful actions do sometimes lead to suffering which led the Hebraic mind to the formulation of the retribution ethic. And today, this retribution ethic is one of the change which oppress many Christians regarding the conception of suffering. However, the truth of the biblical affirmation of a relationship between sin and suffering ought not to be lost. What needs to be communicated clearly and precisely is that suffering is sometimes, but not always, the result of sin. I guess I really want to spend time on this because I think we are so guilty of still going back to the Old Testament concept of suffering.
Well, I would say, you know, the thing that I would add to that is that sin is forgivable. You know,
good.
If we carry the guilt, you know,
good.
Maybe we didn't do this or that, and something happened, but it's not unforgivable.
Good.
You know, and sometimes that's what I call the saving grace of the person, that they finally realize they did it.
Good point.
But you know, it is forgivable.
good. That's one reason I appreciate our time together, is because you people have come up with some key things, and right on. Any other comments?
Let us suppose that someone is suffering as a result of some sinful act. They realize it and they embrace the forgiveness of God. How would that change their suffering then? You know, if the sin is forgiven. I was just interested in pursuing that a little further.
What I feel or see is that sometimes the worst part of suffering is the guilt.
And
to be rid of the guilt.
Okay.
The George Washington story, you put the nail in the wall, his dad made him take it out, the consequences were there, the hole in the wall was still there, but, the nail was gone.
I think guilt too is...
And I think sometimes guilt is...
An example, though, someone who suffers as a result of their own sin, say someone had been promiscuous and contracted herpes. Well, they may have come to a realization of their sin and be granted God's forgiveness for the promiscuity, but they're still suffering
from
the disease, and a disease at this point that has no cure. What do you do with that?
Yeah. Another example is alcohol, how alcohol has just destroyed people's bodies, and they're going to have to continue to suffer. They might, quit drinking.
The consequences of your action are still causing you to suffer. Mm-hmm. Now, you may be forgiven, but you're still suffering.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have the guilt.
You aren't carrying the guilt. You're still going to have the lesions and whatever, also result of herpes, but at least you're not carrying the guilt load.
Good.
And what's the story? Sometimes God cries with us too. Nothing can change it, but you aren't sitting there alone with yourself.
No, thank you.
There's something else too related to that I've seen come up in certain circles at least, and that's sometimes you see somebody. A lot of people around here, in fact, that they're living with God in their heart, and they just have kind of glowing love and effervescence, and they seem very, very happy in their life. But there are some people that just are playing with troubles, and in some cases, they don't have the time of day for the Bible or anything like that. And you're inclined sometimes to think or say, or you hear somebody say, if they only had Christ in their heart, how much easier it would go for them. And I've heard sin called the separation from God, or not just what it says in the Ten Commandments, but a separation. And that's one type of suffering that I think comes from sin. But then again, you can kind of get yourself into a trap, and maybe to take the assumption that if you do have Christ in your heart, if you are one of these people, that you're not going to suffer. He's watching. That isn't necessarily true. Not at all.
Right.
Which I think is what you're trying to say.
Right. I hate to push on, but I think we've been reminded this week what a big subject this is. But just a few comments on suffering is not meaningless, and I think now we get into Paul. And I think the biblical witness is not clear what the meaning, or consistent in affirming what the meaning of suffering is, but it is clear and consistent in affirming that suffering is not meaningless. And I think we find this both in some of the Old Testament writers, Job, Ecclesiastes, and also in Paul. And especially Paul, we learn that suffering is meaningful only through the eyes of faith. And I think this is so important. And in Hebrews 12:7, for those of you who are taking notes, suffering is viewed as a means of growth. It is the discipline that comes to those who are children of God. And the endurance of suffering produces steadfastness, James 1:3. And the one who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, according to 1 Peter 4:1. And one thing that we haven't focused a lot, I think we haven't focused on at all, is that Christian suffering was a means by which we identified with Christ. And this, again, is another big subject. Romans 8:16 and 17, Mark 8:31 following, Mark 15:34, Hebrews 2:10, Hebrews 5:7. The New Testament views of suffering, for the most part, are efforts to formulate the meaning of suffering as it was being experienced by the Christian community. Whether or not such views are helpful to us today in our churches or in our pastoral task of dealing with suffering depends in large part on the condition of the sufferer. Perhaps the Christian view of suffering as it arises from the New Testament may be summarized in this way. Suffering can, by the grace of God, be used as an opportunity for growth and nurture. Apart from the eyes of faith, this seems terribly distorted. But the New Testament faith was so bold as to claim over and over again in different ways that suffering could be used for redemptive purposes by God and the Christian. While God never wills or causes the suffering, God wills a nurturing and redemptive use of the experience of suffering. And please note that I emphasized how important that if suffering is going to have meaning, it has to be in the eyes of faith. You know, I think we get hung up in using some of our own beliefs, projecting on all people. And I think it's within the eyes of faith. Any comments? Okay, and finally, probably the most important for us today is suffering is not the final victor. God eventually triumphs over evil. The biblical witness again and again affirms the eschatological triumph of God over all the forces of evil and suffering. Suffering is not the last word. The affirmation that the day of the Lord would bring God's justice into reality runs throughout the classical prophets of the Old Testament. Daniel is the comforting word that the suffering of the righteous would be vindicated at the last day. The New Testament continues that consistent word of hope to the sufferer. And after you have suffered a little while, God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, establish, and strengthen you, 1 Peter. This biblical view includes the affirmation that suffering is part of the distortion of creation which God will overcome. The kingdom of God, which begins to dawn with the ministry of Jesus, results in the overcoming of suffering and illness, witnessed to by Jesus' healing and exorcisms. The early Christians believed that the kingdom was present in their community, and hence healings were one manifestation of the presence of the kingdom. But it is not until the coming of the kingdom in power that suffering would be defeated entirely. In Revelations, those of you who have been attending these sessions, Revelation 7:17, we read, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And so here we have, we could get back to the question I asked. Would you believe if you didn't believe in a life hereafter? But this is certainly one answer to suffering. Any comments on this last?
Well, I'm wondering, what is the relationship between the Old Testament, who may have had a view, did not yet have a view of a life hereafter, and then consequently saw retribution in this life
right.
as a way of responding to sin. In the New Testament, seeing a life hereafter and seeing some, perhaps, justice be accomplished,
mm-hmm.
and God will triumph,
mm-hmm.
and judgment will also take place.
Mm-hmm.
But that added dimension. Getting back to your question about there was no life
mm-hmm.
hereafter.
Okay, for those of you who are new, I guess two sessions ago, we emphasized that in the early part of the Old Testament, the people of Israel did not believe in a life after death. And so therefore, punishment was in the here and now. And that I think, changes our concept, too, of how we would respond to the suffering.
Well, in a way, though, the afterlife, you know, if we just took that much, the afterlife seems like sort of a sophisticated retribution scheme.
Very good.
If Jesus wasn't there,
Christ
didn't
come
to that picture.
Oh, wow.
I wish I didn't think of things.
Okay.
But Jesus would change
Well, that. I mean, but isn't that true? I mean, you know, well, they're going to get it in the end. I mean, there's a lot of that, and kind of some solace
mm-hmm.
to those who may be suffering, and this may be a contemporary version of some of what the psalmists would say about their own enemies, and you know, God coming down on top of them.
Of course, here we have a problem because you know we don't know what this. Life after is, except that it's either it's separation from God. You know, I think sin is separation. Okay, and for those who don't believe, if that's all it is, it's not going to matter much. You know, because the same separation can be here on earth. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't have to wait to die to be in hell.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait today to have eternal life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Maybe another element.
Could speakers really speak up loud because the poor people that are listening to the tape and are up in the balcony.
I just wanted to add one other element to the idea that life after death and judgment is an extension of the retribution ethic into the next world. I think that's absolutely right. In the gospel, we receive the promise of a merciful, loving God who surprises us in whom he forgives and whom he restores. So we can't be too smug about it, can we? I mean, isn't that the point of the judgment scene in Matthew? Lord, when do we see you naked or something? They're utterly surprised by it. So there is that other element that figures into it, I think.
Well, I just think the whole death and resurrection story changes that from a retribution scheme to something of greater meaning.
I don't know, sometimes I think our time together this week has just added, you know, a lot of questions, but that's okay.
Personally,
mm-hmm.
I feel that inserting justice into the times I've suffered has just been a negative thing. The question of justice is destructive in my handling suffering.
Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to give a personal example, but could you give an illustration so that to explain?
I'm wondering, asking for an explanation of this is destructive in my handling of suffering.
Right. Uh-huh.
Or the, you know, any type of justice consideration for me.
But don't you ponder how much of this personal suffering that one is going through? How much of this is my fault, and how much of this just seems to have been dumped in my lap? And if it is my fault, then maybe I need to get some of my house in order. But if it isn't, and it's been dumped in my lap, then how I respond to it and deal with it will be different.
Yeah.
I guess that's the question I, in my own life, ask myself. You know, how much of this is my responsibility? How much of this has just been dumped on me?
So you can deal with your, if it's your suffering, when it's your responsibility, you can deal with that. But how do you deal with suffering that's been dumped on you?
And so I have to ask the question of the justice so that I know which route to take, because there are different kinds of suffering. You know, there's the kind of suffering of the person who was blind from birth, and they asked, is it because of something his parents did or something he did that he's blind? And Jesus says, you know, neither. But then there's the suffering that of Judas, you know, who brings it upon himself because of his actions. And so I find, I guess, to just respond to you, I do ask that question a lot. And I'm not sure I get any, I've gotten any answers, you know, maybe to that extent it's not helpful, but I ask that question.
When you use the word dump, do you believe God dumps it on you? Is that the question you're
not
asking?
Not that God dumps.
Oh, okay.
No,
That's where I think a lot of people, you know, God dumps
no,
this on
No, I don't believe
and,
God
and,
dumps
you know,
this.
And,
you know, then I see God as my companion in dealing with these things.
Okay.
But if it's something that I'm doing, then sin in fact, you know, is between God and I, and my suffering is because the distance that exists. And
it's time to listen to God.
That would be a facing up to
your own
what's going on, and then deciding, you know, which way to go. So it's not an ignoring of it, or really trying to put justice into this situation.
And it's not to expect, if it is something that, you know, it's just come your way in life, not to blame God for it, or not to blame yourself for it. It's just something that's happened. If someone has MS, you know, it's not something you did, it's not something God did. It's there. And now what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Rabbi Kushner says in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, that maybe there is no justice, it maybe just be bad luck. You know, your neighbor down the street, he goes to church every Sunday, he prays regularly, you know, just all of a good person, what we would summarize as a good person, and look at the bad luck he's mm-hmm. having, but look at this happy-go-lucky fellow here. And instead of the question, why, which we do ask, why does this happen to me? Oh, dear God, why? And maybe we should say, well, it has happened, so what is it I do with this now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good.
How can we go from there?
Good. Yeah. Again, back to the that suffering is a universal condition, it's a reality, you know. And
but there are positive and negative ways to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
There are creative of ways. You know, Paul looks at the thorn in his side, and maybe it's just something that has come his way, but he's learned something important in his relationship with God over that. But then there are people who do destructive things, who are always bemoaning you know, what's happening to them, and there's no life that's coming out of it. And there are two responses, at least two, that you can make.
Yeah, I think another major theme we could have easily focused on is responsibility. Because I think we in the United States are so guilty of not taking responsibility for our actions, that we're always blaming, something happens, we're blaming someone else. We're blaming, the other day someone mentioned parents. Poor parents, they really get blamed for a lot. But we're always, you know, blaming someone else, so, you know, we're never taking responsibility for our own actions. And I think that's in part what you were saying. Someone had...
I was thinking something you said about a person continually hurts oneself by beating on oneself for not being a good enough person, or low self-image kind of stuff. Or even perhaps someone ends up in an alcoholic pattern. I was thinking about how some persons are victims of suffering, totally unjust suffering. If that's a child, and this is why I'm kind of wrestling, if that's a child who grows up with a particular way of viewing life that is, this must be the way it's supposed to be for me, because a child makes no distinction between, a child doesn't know that's unjust in many respects. Then that child has a different problem to handle, because it won't easily be overcome. Suffering will be taken as due. And then that's where I think community really is extremely important. Well, the child never leaves that state.
I don't know, this scene just hit me. My first parish, I was called by the hospital to go to someone's home because she was threatening suicide. And I'll never forget that scene. I raced out to that home, and there was a little boy, the cutest little boy, it must have been 6 or 8. But his response to she was, you know, drunk and everything. His response to everything that was going on was, he appeared to be the most normal kid, you know, but he completely, you know, ignored it and was accepting that as part of life. You know, that was part of life. He went out to play as though nothing happened. I'll never forget that image, because that kid was so cute, you know, and that hit just.
And there's a person who must at some point in their life begin to say, yes, this is unjust. So they have a real need to discover the injustice,
yes,
in order to have the anger and move past all the suffering.
You're saying they should be led to ask the justice question.
Mm-hmm. Right? Because they have not seen it.
Well, I have one other thing that I would like to share with you. I think it'll also cause some discussion, and I guess I would also like to leave you this week with this. And it's from The Immense Journey by Lauren Eisley. He was a student and a writer of animal behavior. And he tells the story of a naturalist who had been hiking in the woods far from civilization. Boy, I'm having trouble again today. Civilization. Toward the end of the day, he felt exhausted, and we can really get into this here in Golden Village, this story. And so he sat down to rest near the edge of a meadow, and he dropped off to sleep, only to be awakened after a time by the most mournful cry of birds. He was nestled in some bushes in such a way that he could see the events in the meadow near him without himself being seen. And there were two small birds circling one area and emitting sorrowful, mournful cries. He looked below these two smaller birds and saw a larger bird in the process of eating the tiny babies in the nest. Obviously, these two smaller birds were the sorrowing parents, helplessly observing the tragic deaths of their young. Soon the larger bird flew to a nearby branch, having completed his meal. And as he sat there, gradually flocks of smaller birds flew into the meadow, coming from every direction until there seemed to be hundreds of them. And each took up the sorrowing cry of the two parents. The entire meadow seemed engulfed in this song of bereavement, which went on and on. The birds were a community of suffering, but gradually it faded out and was followed by a few moments of utter silence. Then one tiny bird somewhere began to sing her song, a melodious, beautiful song. One by one, the others joined in until now the entire meadow was filled with the joyous sound of the song. A community of mourning had formed around the sorrow of these two tiny parents, and now the community of mourning had become a community of affirmation. It is as if the birds were declaring that we share our sorrows together, but we also share the confident affirmation that there is more. There is a victory of life over pain and suffering. And perhaps we humans need to learn from these creatures of nature that what they knew instinctively, that we share in the suffering of others, but we also share in the joy of knowing that suffering is not the last word.
It makes me think, Myrna, what you were telling me the other day about the community that she ministered in, that seemed to have a depressed attitude. Mm-hmm. And one of being immersed in kind of suffering of life, and maybe not seeing anything mm-hmm. other than that. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do you break through? Because pretty soon, what happens is it begins, like you were talking about children, to shape the way you see the world. This is not an exception from the norm. This becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. Now, Christian faith believes that suffering is a part of life, that suffering is not the last word. Then all of us in the church have a responsibility of finding ways of breaking through that paralysis mm-hmm. with images of hope and wholeness in ways that will liberate people mm-hmm. who are caught and stuck. And we as humans don't seem to have that natural rhythm naturally mm-hmm. built within us that may be the birds. But we need each other's community in order to do that, because it's very rarely that we do it by ourselves. Mm-hmm.
That's coming from a terrible pessimist, which I can't be. That's really true. I have a roommate who tends to be a terrible optimist on the other side, and it's been the most wonderful relationship in that sense, because she gives me the hope and I give her some of the realism. And together that community sprouts, which is very, very nice. And that is what you need to do. For someone in depression, you need to be able to show that wholeness and joy to them.
Or show them acceptance and love and hold those things.
But I think we are still left with a dilemma, right? That is that what you were saying?
You mean, what dilemma do you see?
Well, we're left with a dilemma that we aren't instinctive. We're not like the birds. And if there's only one or two people around embracing this faith and this optimism, and there are 50 to 100 people, how can we maintain the energy? And how can we convey the hope?
The problem perhaps with the human beings is I'm not sure that the birds are standing back in judgment on the parents and saying, well, it's your own darn fault. There's none of that judgment about it. And so with our own suffering, See, and so we're so fearful of the judgment that will come, precisely because, like we say, we don't know whether it's just bad luck or we're ultimately responsible. And we're not only have the condemnation of God upon us, but also of our peers. And so we're cautious then with that, which then only causes us to isolate the suffering and isolate ourselves.
The other thing is, we always think we have to say something. You know, some tragedy happens, and we always think you have to make a comment or something. And generally, literature tells us that most of us just want somebody near, touch, an expression of, it hurts me too, I know you're hurting, instead of, I can't understand how this happened to you, and so forth, this kind of thing. So maybe we didn't want to be quite so vocal and more near rather than expressing.
Mm-hmm. That would lead us back to a very New Testament kind of analogy to the presence of God and Jesus the Son.
That's how the Job game got started. I guess you don't know exactly what to do when somebody's suffering, so you give them food.
Oh!
But to go is the most important thing.
Ah.
Jello Brigade. Casserole Brigade.
But the food, too, wasn't that historic where people brought home food and to share and it was a fellowship, and so that these people wouldn't have to cook, they were waited on, someone was covered in them in that way.
And I think a lot of us now are so split up from our families, just location-wise, the way the world is. It used to be in everything that happened, whether it was birth, death, learning something, and how to cook or whatnot, there was family around to teach you to associate with everything that went on. And now, sometimes, you're just completely off on your own in some place. Everybody's too busy going their own separate ways. So you have to find a new family, which is a Christian community.
Does anyone have something that they would like to share before we close?
I guess I have a need to close with a word of prayer. So if we could join together in prayer. Oh God, we know that there are many people who are suffering at this moment. Bless the one who is rarely free from emotional or physical pain, and who would give anything for a restful night. Bless the one whose keenest hopes have been shattered and who has to live with the knowledge that they cannot be restored. Bless those who have to struggle to get up in the morning because work seems so boring or meaningless. Bless the one who has lost a friend and feels their heart is broken beyond all chance of repair. Bless the couple who will never be able to have a child and who is bitterly disappointed about it. Bless the couple who have a child and feel burdened with responsibility and lost freedom. Bless the one whose spouse has died and who has found no comfort in sorrow. Bless the marriage that is in pain and whose hearts are crying in despair. Bless the one who feels very lonely and who longs desperately for some token of friendship. Bless the one who is terrified of falling ill and who walks an endless tightrope of apprehension. Bless the one whose working days are ended and who thinks their usefulness is ended. Bless, O Lord, all who are in pain, or in sorrow, or in sickness. And above all, O loving God, help each one of us not to keep our eyes closed to our hurt, nor to the hurt of others, but help us to be able to reach out our hand in love or arms in embrace to relieve just a little bit someone from their suffering. Amen. Thank you all.
Thank you.